X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube. Hey everybody, welcome back to another all-new X's for Podcast, the show where we take a look at modern Marvels, chronoskim some classics, and more. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me rooting for the mutants at Nico Action. That's N-I-C-O-A-C-T-I-O-N.
Hey everybody, it's Nathan. You can find me online on Twitter at Dazzler AOA. That's like Dazzler in the Age of Apocalypse, where you can find me talking about how much of the machine is Krakoa.
And I'm TK. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at XNateXGrayX. But in the meantime, I will be on StubHub looking for counterfeit tickets to the Hellfire Gala.
Hi, it's me, Steve, and you can find me on Twitter at HowdyDuda, that's H-O-W-D-U-I-D-U-D-A, and you can find me there counting Eternals, like angels on the heads of a pin.
Hi everybody, I'm Jake. You can find me on Twitter at Omega Sentinel, O-H Mega Sentinel, or rooting Druigon in the destruction of all mutants, because I'm an Omega Sentinel.
And that makes me Kevo, and you can find me on all the socials at Kevo Really, K-E-V-O-R-E-A-L-L-Y, and I never get to say this, we hope you survive this experience.
I'm so proud of you. That is, it's amazing because you've been on this show since episode 4, and I don't know that you've ever said, and I hope you survive the experience. This is episode, yeah, and this is like 361. So that is like waiting till that moment in Endgame to say assemble, bro. That is awesome.
And yeah, this is a pretty good moment for it. This is a big deal, especially for me and all the coverage that I've been on for X's for Podcast. I've been covering Eternals for a while, and now here's the big show.
It's here. We're going to burn this bad mother to the ground. I am so excited to have the Eternals crew here to discuss Eve of Judgment, the spectacular one-shot that kicks off the engagement between the Eternals and the Avengers and mutant kind, written by Kieran Gillen with unbelievable art, like top of his game, Pasquale Ferry, color art by Dean White, with letter and design by VC's Clayton Cowles. I just love that they go so out of their way to give it up for the incredible design work on this book, which represents like an unbelievable amount of the storytelling. There's no further to talk about the setup, guys. How did everybody feel with that huge break between Eternals issues?
I have missed them so much. I didn't realize when I was reading this how much I would miss reading the Eternals comic and keeping up on their lives. Like, coming back to this was like meeting an old friend, especially getting to read the world again, the machine.
When I opened the cover of the book and I saw the machine again, I was like, how I missed you, my old friend, my little snarky machine like narrator. I love it. Love it. It's so great. It's good to have the Eternals back. And even though maybe I don't love the direction it's maybe going to go, like I really am so glad to see these guys back. I never realized how much I would fall in love with them.
I do have to say, though, I saw a post on Facebook the other day, some Disney Plus post where they were talking about the Eternals movie. And it was a Drulic Makari post because everyone's so into that pair. And I'm like, the disconnect between what so much of the world thinks the Eternals is, and now what they are going to be presented with, who the Eternals are in this crossover event, like with Druig being Prime Eternal and all of these relationships being so different. I'm so excited to see what non-regular Eternals readers are going to think of these characters when the most recent like pop culture presentation was that film.
And the thing that strikes me about like the disparate points that you're both saying is I did like the film. I liked the film plenty for it being a cool film that was kind of like a scholastic version of the Eternals. Like, what a really fun way to put it into 14 chapters that most people can read, feel good about understanding. Like, I really appreciated that of it. But I'm going to echo what you all have said. The machine, oh my God, it's the next level of consciousness interface. So we have smart devices in our entire home because we're ready for the machine robot war to come take us. And our smart devices need names because, you know, this way you can keep them them organized. And like a true Ascani boy, mine is named Professor. And so I really fucking love how far Kieran Gillen has said, you know what? I want to take ideas like Big Science, Professor from Cable, and sort of the legacy of concept existence from Sandman, but completely make it his own. I'm only comparing it to things because it's such a brave idea to try and understand it. I feel like it's best to explain through comparable notions.
I cannot think of a time when narrative captions were so fundamentally important to a book's understanding of character and subtext since like Claremont. And I don't think Claremont was this good at it. A lot of the time, Claremont would just describe what's on the panel. A lot of the time, narration boxes are used in such a way as to like fill out stuff that the writer maybe didn't think of to put in the thought bubbles or the speech bubbles, or maybe to replace thought bubbles, or maybe to capitalize on the art not covering what is really going on. But The Eternals by Kieran Gillen and his various collaborators is a rare example of when narrative captions are almost necessary to really understanding what's going on with the characters and minds of these characters, especially if you haven't been reading them for decades now. If you're just jumping in, it's great because it gives you, here's what their personalities are, here's how they think, and it reminds you of that so that whenever there is scheming or manipulation going on in page, it's a careful reminder that says, hey, here's a fun way to let you know this is what's actually going on. And it's done in such a way that it doesn't feel lazy, it doesn't feel cheap, it doesn't feel like it's not taking advantage of the comics medium like a lot of narrative captions do.
Reminds me so much of the narrator from Into the Woods.
Give me a rapping witch any day.
I mean, well, it's like, you know, it's both a character and kind of a remove from the characters and from the story. It's both like telling the story and it's embedded in the story. And it's just so personable and friendly and approachable and funny and makes Deep Space Nine jokes. So I was trying to go over like of this new generation of Eternals, like who's my favorite? I think the Machine is probably my favorite because it's the most approachable and, you know, grounded in some ways. That's an Earth joke. I think it's a really clever way of getting us caught up and also just sort of like easing some of the tension. This is a really tense story. This is a really violent story. And this kind of softens it a little bit and reminds us, oh, we're in comics. It's okay. Like we can enjoy this violence.
Exactly. I love that note of it reminds us that it's a comic a little bit. And that's okay. It doesn't make the story less poignant or anything like that, but it's putting a little bit of a pin on it.
And I love how even though it's, you know, sort of the omniscient narrator, it's a very unreliable narrator because it's only telling you exactly what you need to know in that moment. Like if it was a perfect omniscient narrator, like we would have known about the Krakoa machine connection earlier, but like it's doing it smartly and almost in a very human way, which is crazy for a machine for the whole world.
And there have been these little moments of, oh, did I not tell you that? Oh, I must have forgotten to tell you. Oh, and by the way, you know, even as the story continues to go on.
Very Princess Aralon at the start of the Lynch Dune. The Eternals are at their most grounded, to borrow a phrase from Jake, still really out there in the comics and kind of difficult to identify with. We see ourselves reflected in a lot of different parts of the Marvel Universe and a lot of different characters. I think at times there's even a way where it can work for groups like the Inhumans. They haven't quite managed to pull it off, but it can be there. The Eternals are the one where it's like, none of us are eternal space god robots trying to protect the world from like biohazard space god freak creatures. So there's like nothing there really to identify with. And they've gone even higher concept with it lately, which all of it super good, super fun to read. But it's funny that our POV character has this voice that is so familiar to all of us and is really funny and that we can all enjoy. But it's the Earth that is sentient. Like it's the least possible thing that we could identify with in this entire thing. And yet it is our grounding character and moment that we really need, because otherwise this would just be maybe a little bit too grand of a space opera for us to identify with in the same way that we identify with everything else in the Marvel Universe. And especially if we're going to talk about pitting the Eternals against the Avengers and the X-Men, we do need something that slightly humanizes them. Otherwise it'll just be like, wow, I really hate all these characters and I hope the Avengers and the X-Men kill them.
Speaking of humanizing the characters, I do think that, like, as much as most of the Eternals are not very relatable, Sina is continuing in her tradition of being the most relatable Eternal to me.
and likable.
She's somebody who's always been grounded by her love.
Yeah, so likable.
But like also her continued interest in art criticism and evaluation is intensely relatable personally to me. I mean, that's why I do this kind of thing. But like, I love that she sees that whole scene where she talks to Crow about Thanos being a collaborator rather than a critic, the way that he thought, is a really interesting recontextualization of Talos' art, which allows her to keep it in memory as something that still carries on and that its message reverberates, and she takes it and makes it a part of her ethos going forward. And I find that to be the least alien of anything that any of the Eternals do.
And I really love that. There's so many layers that are revealing themselves to me as the story unfolds itself more. I don't know if it's that I found the moment relatable so much as I saw something in that confrontation between Icarus and Crimson Carlisle, where she's coming at him and he de-escalates from it, and she's like, that still just proves me right, and he's like, you're right, it does. And he has this moment of realization, and I really felt like it was this interesting parallel for any kind of coming to realize prejudices in yourself and trying to become a better ally and realizing there's ultimately no ever making up for the things that you had done when you should have been better. And that's not an excuse for not continuing to try and do better. And it was presented in such a way that I don't think that it was an anvil on the audience's head, but it still hit me really hard at this moment of, yeah, allyship means always saying you're sorry, yeah, and always trying to be better, and seeing a powerful white man like Icarus still continue down this road of, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry, it sucks, and I was wrong, and I am going to be making up for this for as long as I am trying to make up for this. And it was a really interesting moment, and it's really interesting to see the things they are trying to tell through these eternal, immortal, incredibly powerful characters.
Something about Icarus as an Eternal that is so powerful in that moment, and Kevo, I completely agree, it struck me so hard, is that his apology is so good because he, unlike a lot of living people who need to apologize better, he can see the long game, and he is not concerned about being popular again and liked again in this moment. He's not concerned about, like, you need to stop being mad at me, you need to accept me back. He's saying, like, I'm just going to keep making amends. I'm going to keep doing things for your benefit. I'm going to reject my people, and maybe someday you'll come around, but that doesn't matter. Like, what matters is that I make up for it. That hits me like a ton of bricks.
Whether or not you come around is not contingent on my help. I need to keep helping you. Yes. Either way.
A reveal of how weakness interplays with strength and our understanding of what makes someone strong, the places that these characters can be hit or couldn't be hit. For me, that point contrasted with seeing Sinister bound helpless. The thing that did for me in terms of what we're discussing is, first of all, Sinister. I mean, I don't even understand how you commit genocidist napping. I don't even understand how you do it, number one. But there is something about how helpless he is. And we put that in context with the level of power that Sinister plays with over an immortal X-Men. And now you introduce that to these characters and you show the dilemma that they're having and the still yet certainty of their convictions and their decisions at this point. There is something insane about telling us that Sinister, the mutant we thought was an 11, is a 2 here compared to these characters. And they're the ones having this huge philosophical debate where he is in stasis like a footnote. That's insane.
I think they don't know what they've caught. I think they've got a bear in a bear trap, and they don't know how dangerous he is because he can still reset. If he gets back to his lab and he kills his Moira, he gets his save scum. I think that they think they understand the level that this mutant thing, however they view him, this geneticist genocidal maniac who has manipulated an Eternal, they think they know his power level. I get the sense that he, like Druig, is such a master of manipulation that he's going to turn their own machinations against them, at least for a little while.
It's kind of funny that the Eternals, who are very long-lived in this particular situation, appear to be playing a much shorter game on the whole than the mutants, who are playing a game throughout time and space and have a bunch of different contingencies, not even really thinking about the Eternals yet as their enemy, where the Eternals are already starting to think of mutants as the enemy and broadly have kind of evaluated everyone in the Marvel Universe and on the Earth in terms of their threat potential. Everything that they have set up right now is very immediate. And yes, they do have Sinister, and they sucked him right out of the island, and it makes everybody seem very weak and like they're not at all prepared. But give any kind of opening to any mutant, including, yes, Sinister, if he escapes in any way and can just make it back to the island, he can reset. A lot of other mutants that are going to be in this conflict, if they have an inch to open the door, they can fully bust that thing open and really take the Eternals down. And I think it's just, it goes to show what a sort of state of upheaval this group of people are in, that they're not really in any way taking into account the enormously long lives that they have led. And it's really only Druig, who himself is also missing a lot of these points, that really gets the necessity of the long game.
They've been doing it so long that they're sort of losing sight of
them. Yeah, they're taking it for granted.
Yeah, whereas the mutants are just like all about long game right now, because it's the first time they've ever...
They know they can't die. They have to completely redo all their rules.
Yeah, and this is the first time they haven't had to like just fight for survival as much as they did before, where they can actually start plan, create a culture, start thinking of long term. Okay, yeah.
I really love all of this long game, short game discussion as a metaphor for a lot of what's actually really even going on in the real world right now, in terms of, you know, a lot of people are long-sighted and they have that Star Trek vision of the future, and, you know, we'll get there and we're working towards it. And I think because we've, you know, been around so long as a species and we feel so confident, we often forget about the short game and we forget about the short-term things that could really muck up our long-term plans, because we're just so confident in having been around for so long, like the Eternals themselves. And there's something to be said for these immortal figures forgetting themselves and forgetting that, you know, something can come along and really mess up your whole world.
Yeah, I really appreciate the Machine making a slight reference to that, even with having the mutants and saying they were smart enough to found their nation in a lovely climate. They're not even worried about the seas rising because their island home is sentient and can move. Oh, what a lovely day for everyone. Pointing out not so subtly that there are great swaths most of the planet that are not in the capacity to move when the seas rise, you know.
I think at least some of the shift in the upheaval that we're seeing with the Eternals is this, you know, going back to this existential crisis. The Celestials have completely uprooted their sense of what their mission was. For thousands and thousands of years, they were like, oh, this is what it means to be an Eternal. We are the superior species. We, you know, we control excess deviation. We know what we're about. We know what our mission is. And for the first time in their very, very long lives, they're without that. And they've been told that what they thought their mission was actually not the case. I think of the psychic shock, and not in the like telepathic sense, but in the like emotional, yeah, psychological sense that would bring to a people. Like, I get why Ajax and Makari are freaking out right now about their deities. You know, I get why there is a huge like leadership upheaval among the Eternals, why every faction seems so separate, and why there doesn't seem to be any sense of real integration. The Unimind is fractured even and divided in who leadership should go to. You know, this is a people that have lost their way. This is a people that have no sense of who they are anymore, and they're just flailing, trying to find themselves again. And I think that's so interesting and so entertaining, because we don't really get to see, I mean, with the exception of maybe Thor, we don't get to see a lot of the existential crisis of a god. It's such a cool story.
For anyone who's caught up on the current era of Doctor Who, it's what I love so much about some of the recent revelations they've had about the Doctor and the Doctor's mythos, and a lot of people are very up in arms. But I feel like, you know, it's a similar situation where they'd gotten themselves into this place of being so steeped in these heavy themes of the Doctor being this like ancient white male savior, and the things they've done to the mythos recently very much shakes up that idea, and I feel frees the character to be a lot more things than it was boxed in before. And I think it's a very similar theme in terms of, you know, immortal figures thinking they will never change and being confronted with this new thing. You know, even someone that ancient can learn new things about themselves. And that's a hard thing for even someone who's friggin' 30 to accept, let alone someone who's millennia old.
It's hard enough for Ajax and Makari that they are willing to propose some radical theology and create create their own god. Who was it who said that if God did not exist, we would have to create him? That is the most radical.
I think Yogi Berra said that.
Also, XTC said it in Dear God. So
there you go. And that probably came first before Yogi Berra. So it's XTC.
Likely. Yeah. And the Sarah McLachlan cover came before all philosophy. So it's really, I think the character that might even showcase this as a point of reflection so well is an Eternal who can't change. Domo, who is shown in such exquisite color in contrast to all of the color around him. Domo's inability to change and simply being science for the sake of science makes all of this learning and all of this emotional turmoil created by the, like, you know, we're always talking about the X-Men and how their evolution, and now the X-Men's evolution is they can't die. Well, the Eternals, they already had that down. Their evolution is now they're thinking about other people's mortality as more than, oh, we're here to save you. There's something so powerful about that.
I think the kind of science that he does says a lot about his actual personality. We're kind of led to believe that he doesn't have much of a personality outside of the pursuit of science, but it's like, he's like, well, ethics doesn't factor in because he only cares about science. But then later they tell us that his curiosity extends to political science. So his curiosity does not extend to ethical science. It's an interesting where his... Domo has a personality. Maybe we're not meant to think he is, but his personality is probably that he's kind of an asshole.
I would be remiss if I didn't say, I just thought this was some of the best art. I mean, I can't stop saying that about Eternals one-shots. Like, yes, the main book, stunning in that, like, and again, stunning in a way that, like we said, sexy pudding people. But this is stunning in a different way.
Beautiful and, bombs.
Yes, the beautiful bombs, gorgeous bombs.
Gorgeous.
And the colors are incredible.
The bomb is ready for the Hellfire Gala.
The bomb is ready for the Hellfire Gala.
Yeah, I'm very fond of Pascal Ferry's art in general. I've always really appreciated it. And I like, there's a thing that he does that is occasionally off-putting to people. And I think it's something that Asad Rabich also does. So we're keeping in character for this series, I think, which is that he draws faces as like vaguely inhuman and strange. So like there's a panel of Icarus when he's looking down after having dropped Crimson and Cersei is tying them up. And Icarus is just looking down with his furrowed, extremely heavy brow and his eyes that are a little bit too large in the iris. And his face is so craggy that he looks like a Kirby man or a Skrull from like really early Kirby art in Marvel superhero comics. And it makes him look just like vaguely inhuman. He doesn't look like a regular human who is beautiful and has powers. He looks like something else that looks kind
of... He's not like a regular human. He's like a cool inhuman.
Yeah, I think he looks accidentally humanoid in a way that I really like. And I think a lot of the Eternals do in this issue.
I love the style overall. Like the art is beautiful. I do have a little bit of a problem with the faces. They are all consistent. They are all, you know, individual. So you can tell that each face had an individual style. It's just maybe not my normal jam on that. Athena looks a little bit like Barbie to me and some of the stuff. I love the use of lettering on this as well.
And Crow looks so pretty.
Crow does look really pretty.
Crow looks so pretty.
Nightcrawler looked pretty. Yana looked pretty. And they're barely in it. Hey, you know what? Even Beast. Shout out, Beast. Great to see you writing him, Kieran. Kieran's big breakthrough for X-Men was Sword. So, you know, back when Beast was palatable. So I loved the cute little X-Men pop in, everybody looking sexy.
I'd love to, like, how, like, literally this is the first branded thing of the Eve of Judgment event, like the Axe event. And, like, it is straight up an Eternals book. It's unabashedly, unapologetically Eternals. They're popping in pictures of the other characters, but, like, no doubt about it, this is an Eternals event.
This art didn't really work for me, especially for the first issue of the Judgment Day event. It is really gorgeous. It's interesting. It's unique because this is such an epic event that getting distracted by the eccentricities of the art kind of tripped me up from getting into the, we're about to go into epic Marvel mode.
I mean, that said, the backgrounds in this issue are gorgeous. Like, I love these settings. There's a lot of geometry. There's a lot of texture. I love the bodies. It is a lot of the facial stuff that really I find most pulls me out of the story. There's a panel with Icarus with Cersei where her eyes are entirely purple and she kind of looks like a cross between like a Romulan and a fairy. And it's not that I don't think that that looks beautiful. It just doesn't really register as Cersei the Eternal for me.
There's a moment on digital page 18 where there's three panels of Cersei and her head is a different shape in every single one. Pascal Ferry would be an amazing artist to do another 12 issues of an Eternal run just because this one really needs to kick off this huge event that this just didn't quite do for me what I was hoping it would.
I agree to a large extent with a lot of your criticisms, especially the distraction and the fact that everybody's faces are a little off model. This reminded me, and this is just a brief tangent, but I was just thinking about this. I've been reading through the first 10 issues of Amazing Spider-Man for the first time ever, and you would not believe how mean everybody is when writing in about Steve Ditko's art.
Oh, same. Done it recently with you.
Oh, good. That's wonderful. I when people write in about Steve Ditko's art, like, people were extremely harsh back then. I think we are all much more respectful now, unbelievably, even though, like, yes, death threats are a thing. But, like, people would write
in. People coming for Kirby layouts is crazy.
People would write in every single issue ever since Dr. Doom and the Fantastic Four first appeared in it to say how bad Steve Ditko was at drawing Jack Kirby's characters. And the letters evolve over time to where people soften on that, and they start to say things like, well, Jack Kirby also couldn't draw Spider-Man as well as Steve Ditko. You know, so it's interesting how, like, immediately people saw their faves, but drawn by another artist with a wildly different but also good style. And, like, the first reaction was absolutely, like, Steve Ditko sucks. When will he learn how to draw? Even Stan Lee was, like, writing, like, oh, he's sending out for drawing classes. Poor Steve having to read that all to his face. Not a guy I very much like, but still, poor guy. But it was interesting to see how the fans over time were like, well, actually, it seems like these two are well-suited to their styles and they can't do each other's work. And something about that felt very parallel to talking about Pascal Ferry doing Assad Ribich's work, for example.
It's almost a comfort to see, though, that people have never changed.
If you're following me on Twitter, listeners, I am absolutely going to pick a bunch of the meanest things people have written in to tell Steve Ditko to his face, and I will be posting those.
We actually do something similar in the Billy Club, the partner show to this, where we cover Daredevil from the beginning. I pick a letter where they say things like, here's what I think would make Daredevil better. Number one, get rid of the blind thing.
Number two. Yep.
Oh, totally.
I'm not surprised. It's just a lot to hear when you don't expect it.
And it's stuff like, the book was good until you had Jack Kirby come in to do layouts.
Yeah.
And Ooh. You're just like, I can't breathe. I literally can't breathe reading this. And so Tori sits there with her jaw on the floor, and she's like, these disrespectful fanboys, I'm going back in time and punching someone.
I've read so many interesting letters in early Marvel comics. I highly recommend everybody go through and actually read those letter columns, please. There's one person who deserves to be gone back in time and beat up for the way they talk about Storm.
The uncomfortable amounts of racism.
So I wasn't exactly partial to this art or anything. Like, it wasn't exactly my favorite in the first place. I think it's good, but I think for me, I had less of a reaction to it than the rest of y'all might have, because I am such a less frequent comic book writer, and I think I had absolutely no expectations for what the art should look like for a crossover. To me, this just looked like a lot of the same art from the Eternals arc that we'd already been covering, and I think as an introduction to this crossover event that is through the lens of the Eternals mostly, I think for that it sort of worked. I don't know that this art would continue to work as you're bringing in other characters from other worlds, but, like, you know, we're talking about these artists, but so for me it was just more of the same of the Eternals art that we'd already been covering. But it's really interesting to me hearing people with more comic reading experience who are saying, you know, you expected something different. That's really fascinating.
There's a bomb and they're gonna kill all the mutants, and then they can't kill them because Krakoa and the Machine are, like, inexorably linked, and so that immediately changed a lot of what Judgment Day is going to be for me, which is interesting because I've been coming at a lot of this with, oh, the Eternals want to wipe out the mutants. I really fucking hate that this is called Eternals, Avengers, X-Men, when it is clearly Eternals, Avengers, mutants.
Yeah.
It is not just X-Men, especially when we've gone so out of our way as a line to separate that the X-Men live in a fucking tree and their vote is stupid. So I don't really know why we're calling this X-Men.
Well, and because AIM doesn't look as cool.
So I'm left thinking what had been a battle in sort of a Civil War-y punch 'em, fuck 'em ups is now going to be a battle for cultural real estate. And this is going to be, if Krakoa can't be removed from the Machine in any convenient way, do they just have to make Krakoa theirs? Like, this changed everything for me in a way that made my heart skip a beat.
Okay, so like, the crazy thing is, now I'm going back and I'm thinking, like, maybe I should have seen this coming since the first issue of Eternals, because there's so many similarities. Like, you've got the overarching, the machine versus Krakoa, like, and Krakoa as, like, the overarching piece of the thing. Like, and does this finally really, like, explain the mutant gateways that they use with the flowers? Because the Eternals have their own gateways that they use. And, like, this, like, almost, like, how did I not see that? Like, if with all these similarities between, like, the weird, how do you explain this teleportation because flowers can't teleport people, to, like, a lot that has been there. And I know there's probably going to be some strong cases that'll come out where people will, like, step by step list out everything, but, like, those, the two big ones right now that I think of is, you know, just the big overarching thing and the gateways.
Yeah, also I like that little Krakoa is a nice guy. Did they date?
Well, I'm wondering, too, if that isn't a subtle arrow pointing towards the resolution. Like, the fact that the machine and Krakoa are inextricably linked means that the Eternals and mutants are inextricably linked, and that's pointing towards the eventual resolution of this story. We're seeing a sect of Eternals trying to make their peace with the Deviants, and, you know, we're casting mutants as Deviants in this new era, so I'm curious about whether or not that's the kind of ultimate outcome of what this story will be, although it's probably way too early to make that kind of claim. I really like the poetry of the machine and Krakoa being interdependent.
Yeah, I agree. It echoes so much of what we've learned about the deviant line to the mutants, you know, the deviant to mutant pipeline.
And whoa, wait, Arako too. So this is gonna, like, because Arako and Krakoa were one, right? So is the part of the machine on Mars now? Like, oh my god.
Maybe the mutants have in fact expanded the machine.
I'm just trying to imagine the kind of, like, Marvel Universe internal cultural response to this. All right, well, we made things better with the mutants by giving them an island and a planet, so let me take a look in the Rolodex. Listen, we have the Falkland Islands available, and also Uranus and Eternals. Do you guys want a planet and an island? We're really just trying to start shifting you people out of our way, because what could, is this a big design? Like, and are the Inhumans just gonna get the moon? Are we just gonna cede the moon to the Inhumans at this point? I love the potentiality for the largeness that this is going to mean for everything.
I think one of the big game-changing moments for me was the, like, bold statement that there isn't really much going on with the mutants being derived from the Deviants. This is all just Druig trying to come up with a party line to get everybody to rally around. Because I remember early on when this crossover got announced, a lot of people were thinking, they're saying that there's something really wrong with mutants, and this is going to turn into, like, part of the whole, are mutants actually kind of overstepping? Are they bad? And I did expect going into this that it was going to be a little bit more like the interplay of all these different forces. And in a lot of ways, it still is that. But I loved that right from the get-go, what is said is that it doesn't really matter that mutants and deviants have a connection of some kind. It is just Druig trying to consolidate power and give his people a mission that he can use to control them. I think that's really important. I think it's important for fans to have that perspective early on, because I also think it will get shifted. We're seeing in Hellfire Gala and Immortal X-Men that there are still a lot of problems with how mutants run their business. And that can be true, and still the Eternals can be wrong for how they're going about what they're doing. And that does appear to be what is being set up. And I like that it was so plain right from this very first issue.
Yeah, you got to convince the X-Fans that the Eternals are not actually all bad guys like the Inhumans are.
And that brings us to really close to the close of our coverage of this one shot. And it's so dumb. I don't want to, like, it's dumb, but, like, you know when, like, there's a moment in a run that chokes in your throat? Like, I think about that moment where I first discovered how perfect the synergy was at New X-Men, where all the titles somehow aligned, how you kind of see it again at Reload, you see it again at House of X. There's, like, a really magical thing where when you think, oh, and that book was doing this, and that book was doing this, and that's really kind of how I feel about these discussions about Eternals, and the way our mosaic of opinions on these characters comes together to build the overall picture of how fandom may see this and how a specific group of fans see it. And I am more excited to cover Judgment Day with you guys than ever, and I am so grateful that this one shot was such a fascinating jumping off point. Before we go, I'd like to get everybody's closing thoughts on this and what they hope to see in Judgment Day.
Excluded E is Eros. Yeah.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he definitely is. I mean, in...
very excited to see Exclusion E come back into the Eternal story in a big way, especially with the new style that they're giving them. Star Fox seems to be living their absolute best look right now, or will be when we see them again.
What I hope to see is an event that can sort of elevate Eternals to a higher level with the broader general consensus. I mean, because this is honestly, if you're like an X-Men fan or an Avengers fan and not really reading a lot of the general Marvel Universe, this might have been the first Eternal story you would have read. And if this is the first Eternal story you read, like, go back and read this last series that just came out by Gillen. It's amazing. Like, it revitalizes the line in a way that's just so good. What I want to see, though, is that, you know, they're able to come out with that elevated status, but not totally destroyed. Like, I think IVX kind of destroyed the Inhumans for a lot of people outside of, you know, like, just normal Inhuman fans.
All seven of them.
Yeah. Hey, I want to be clear. I was joking about the Inhumans all being bad guys. The Inhumans are not all bad guys. Triton did nothing wrong.
All seven of their fans are, oh, nope, someone just stopped caring. Now there's six. All six of their remaining fans.
It did not go well for the Inhumans. I think Marvel was trying to lift them up and promote them, but fandom is like, wait, you're willing to perform genocide just to get powers? That's crazy.
We've been driving towards a big status quo shift for the entire Marvel universe. It's happened for the X-Men, but we're still really delving into what that means. It's happened for the Avengers, which established a lot of the concepts that are being brought up in this Eternals run. We're going to get to a point where we will have a very different understanding of how broadly, historically, and mythologically we got to the place we're at today. And I think there's a very distinct possibility that Miracle Man could also become a part of that. So I think we're heading towards... I think we're heading towards something...
Sorry, that's my dramatic Miracle Man is coming.
We're going to need it, because I think we're heading towards a very different view of the comic book Marvel universe. And I am excited to get there, but I'm excited to see all of these little pieces that have been set up and played with in their own right really get picked up and put on this entirely new board where we're getting this hyper concentration of a 3 or 4 month event that's really going to take us through a lot of exercises in all the stuff that's been set up. And at the end of it all, I think we're going to be in a very different place for how we view characters and parts of the Marvel universe and how we got here. And I am excited to see where that takes us long term going forward for these stories.
And I want to be there already. I don't know why I signed up for this. I have ADHD. I can't handle this kind of like long-term storytelling anymore. We don't do this anymore. We're the Netflix era now. We drop things. I really so strongly agree with everything that you're saying. And oh my gosh, this is going to take forever, isn't it? I'm not
your
like
kingdom
y'all.
For an OGN.
I'm not like y'all. I don't do this sort of thing. I read stuff that's like done.
No, Kevo, I feel the same way.
To watch this live.
Kevo, that is why X Twitter is so unhinged, is because the vast majority of us have ADHD and we have to read comics once a month.
It's horrific.
Yeah.
There's only one thing I really hope to see, and that's, you know, I was standing in a comic shop yesterday and I heard a gentleman say to his, I believe, lady friend, that you don't need to read this upcoming event because he already can tell that it looks like every other The X-Men fight everyone. You know they're just going to win. First of all, I can't think of any crossover The X-Men have won ever.
Yeah, did they win AVX? Survived. I feel like they won AVX.
Yeah, no. They survived the moral thing.
They won the moral argument of AVX.
Oh, that's true.
IVX, they kind of...
I feel like a lot of people didn't think they did, though. I feel like a lot of people were like, no, the X-Men really are terrible. Like, and that's a type of person. Anyway,
it is a type. Yeah.
I was like, IVX, did they win? I mean, they kind of did.
Again, they won the moral argument. The X-Men always have the moral high ground because they're the marginalized people who are being attacked constantly while the powers of the world stand back and do essentially nothing.
But the fact that they got sucked into IVX is a loss in and of itself. The fact that they even had to participate in that event was a loss.
Exercise and futility and frustration.
Well, and so I love that that was the most excited the room got all episode. That was amazing. And so the thing about it that really made me so happy was 1 minute later, I saw pretty much the exact same dynamic group walk in, two people, guy with his apparent lady friend. And she said, "What's this?" And he said, Oh, it's by Kieran Gillen. Cool dude. You should read it for yourself. See if you like it. You probably will. And it was this. And, you know, it didn't actually have X-Men in it, despite the fact that there were three X-Men on the cover, making a random stranger think that this might have X-Men in it, you know? But the fact that there's like four panels of X-Men and then there's like two or three X-Men on the cover is very misleading.
Oh, I got the variant cover that has all kinds of X-Men and Avengers on the cover. And
that's baffling. But, you know, other than the confusion there, I was just so happy to see that there's some fans that are ready to give this a try. Of course, you've got your, as we've discovered since 64, garbage fans, but there's still something lovely about this idea that people are still willing to give this idea a try after so many restarts in a similar vein, since this is so different.
I'm just glad my first big crossover has such a cool name. IVX sounds terrible.
It was.
Sounds like a medication that you're getting administered to you.
Yes.
Because Axe Eve of Body Spray is better.
It is. It is the Axe Body Spray of comics.
I am fine with that.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Nico here again, and we hope you guys enjoyed that coverage of Eve of Judgment, which kicks off the amazing Judgment Day event, which is officially underway as of today. Super excited to get that segment out there. Now, of course, our team did all of the Eternals by Kieran Gillen, Asad Ribic, and so many amazing other artists who have contributed to the unbelievable redefinition of a team that has long been a part of the Marvel mythos. We have a number of amazing other segments coming your way today. Next up, we're going to bring you Legion of X number 3, and then a look at Sabretooth numbers 4 and 5 to close out the series. As always, we love bringing you guys this show 3 times a week every week. That's MC2 Mondays for the rest of the summer, taking a look at Modern Marvels on Wednesdays, and XI4P Premiere Fridays. We're going to be covering as many angles of the Judgment Day event as we can, so keep a keen ear out for that, as well as any other surprises Marvel is going to throw our way between SDCC and C2E2 all summer long. As always, you can check the show out at X is for Podcast on Twitter and xisforpodcast.com. I'm Nico. You guys can find me at Nico Action, NicoAction, as well as finding my work in some incredible places like the Young Men in Love anthology, as well as Kid Riot, available at kidriotcomics.com, as well as on Comixology. So until next time, guys, keep those mutant lights lit, those Krakoan gateways open, enjoy these last two segments, and we'll see ya.
Hello and welcome back to X is for Podcast, where we read through Marvel's many monthly titles. It's me, Steve, and you can find me on Twitter at Howdy Duda. That's HOWDYDUDA.
And I am Steven, and you can find me on Twitter at Steven of Wonder, and over on Facebook as an admin for the House of Northstar group.
Hey everybody, it's Nathan. You can find me online at Dazzler OA. That's like Dazzler in the Age of Apocalypse, where you can find me on Twitter talking about how majestic and amazing Aura Serrata is.
And I'm Jonah, and you can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at Peak Jonah. That's PEAK. Hope you survived this experience. Unlike Banshee ? Who looks like an actual Banshee now.
He cannot catch a break in any book he ever appears in.
I saw that page and I was like, what in the Jason Heron is this? Banshee as Ghost Rider.
I think it's kind of an homage to like his first appearance in X-Men ever, but I just don't understand why he is always tortured. Always. This has happened to him several times.
I wish he had a break from being tortured after the extremely gruesome and upsetting death at the hands of Moira. There's nothing Banshee looks more like than DC Comics' Banshee in this.
Yes.
We're all here talking about Banshee because we're all here talking about Legion of X number 3, We're All Mad Here. Written by Cy Spurrier, art by Jan Busseldua, colors by Federico Blay, letters by Clayton Cowles of VC, and designed by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen.
When this book first was announced, I was really excited because the cast of characters I thought was really fascinating. You know, when Wave X ended and we got this precursor image to what Legion of X was going to be, we see Nightcrawler, we see Legion, origin. We see Juggernaut, which is amazing. We see Forget-Me-Not, who's a character that I guess a lot of people forgot about. We see Pixie again, and we see Ruth there, and we're like, wait, what is Ruth doing there? She's supposed to be dead. No precogs allowed at this point. And this is all before, you know, Mystique does her badass to get Destiny back. So I think there was a lot of, at least from our team's perspective, a lot of anticipation of what was going to happen in Legion X, because we have this really cool cast of characters, and they're kind of essentially, they claim they're not cops, but essentially they're the mutant police. And we're now on issue 3. There's unfortunately a lot of really interesting ideas that are being played with and talked about, but I don't know if everything is becoming cohesive. It's kind of like having a really good main dish with three like great or good separate components, but nothing's really working harmoniously for me. And I'm still a little confused of what is this book actually meant to be about?
I think I know what this book is about, and I think it's about three pretty separate things that Spurrier is trying to interweave. A story about like the various kinds of policing or punishment or law that is carried across Araco and Krakoa, because I mean, the first book introduces Nightcrawler's cop shop and his new pretty soulless way of policing his fellow mutants because he decided that he must and that it is his job to do so on his own. But we also see Aura Serrata, and she fulfills a very, like, if not similar, sort of parallel function over in her place. And Weaponless Zen is essentially a cop in her own way, or maybe like a Skip Tracer bounty hunter. But yeah, I can see what is attempting here, but introducing the gods storyline, which is way more interesting. The whole idea of the Araco people needing to test out their gods first, test drive them, and demolishing them if they don't measure up. It's all very interesting, but it's really difficult to make those two into one cohesive story that works together. And as insofar as I don't actually want to see any like human style policing on Krakoa, I would much rather focus on the god part. And unfortunately, I think that the two are going to be tied up together because the god is a perp in this situation.
There's just so much going on, and I don't really love books that are chaos for chaos's sake. I'm a little bitter because part of this storyline feels like it should be an X-Factor storyline. So I feel kind of robbed of those characters handling this situation because they have barely appeared since that book ended. I was actually kind of excited about this book because even though there's a couple characters that I really do not care for, I love Nightcrawler, Juggernaut, and I loved the idea of reading Forget-Me-Not in this book, but I just have not been able to connect with it.
There's way too much going on here. Sizemary has done a lot of books that I've really enjoyed. Maybe I didn't love Way of X before Legion of X, so maybe that's why I'm not really resonating with Legion of X. There's some really fun and cute moments in the book. Like, I do still get a kick out of Kane always forgetting who his partner is. I get a kick out of seeing Kurt get to flirt with this new Weaponless Zen, even though while he like goes through his mental mindscape, we get yet another foster sibling fantasy from Kurt.
Oh my god, yeah.
This time it is not Amanda Sefton. This time in his dreams he is kissing Rogue.
Yeah, I don't love that.
I don't love that.
Yeah, why do they keep doing that with him? Like, that's so crazy. And it's not even just Cy Spurrier. Like you said, it was the Amanda Sefton thing too back in the day. Stop doing that to him. Please, Marvel.
I don't think Spurrier has a good take on Kurt. Spurrier tends to focus on all the things of Kurt that I think writers focus on when they don't like really get who this character used to be. The Claremont era is not the be-all end-all of characterization, but in this case, like, I don't think a lot of writers really get Kurt post-Claremont, and a lot of people will focus on him as like a serious and dogmatic Catholic, which never works for me because he never was a very good Catholic, and religion was never like a huge part of like every part of his life. Maybe he's become more religious as he's gotten older, but I often feel like Spurrier chooses to highlight that at the expense of like his emotional intelligence or his love for bombastic celebration and his sexuality and his adventurous sense. In this issue, at least, we finally get Kurt doing some like swashbuckling to a small extent, dressing up as a pirate, and, you know, his sexuality. But again, like, his sexuality is like pulled up, and of course they have to go back to the Kurt loves his sister thing, but with a different sister. And it's just like, it always feels like it's focusing on the parts of Kurt that are the joke parts. And it never feels like love for the character. I'm not going to speak for the writer because I don't know how he actually feels about Kurt, but he chose Kurt to be the main character, so obviously he has some love for him. It's not exactly the Nightcrawler I love.
I'm glad that you brought up sexuality, because I actually have in my notes that the book is is tragically heterosexual. Like, the Krakoan era is so inherently queer to me, and this book feels like such a weird, like, regression. Like, it sticks out like a sore thumb to me compared to the others. I'm not sure if I'm the only one who feels that way, but I don't get any form of, like, queerness in this book at all.
Yeah, it feels very queer from the writing standpoint. I would like to say, speaking of queer, what my favorite thing about the series, and the thing I actually do enjoy from issue to issue, and the reason I'm still picking it up, is the incredible art by Jan Basaldúa and the color by Federico Blay, which works so well with it. Like, yeah, the combination of color and art team on this, and Jan Basaldúa is somebody who I liked a lot a long time ago, and I feel like people really undersold her on a lot of stuff, but the growth in her art over time has been incredible, and she's gone from a very, like, softer cartoony style to something much more closer to Bob Quinn's, like, bombastic, huge, dramatic event stuff, and just the combination of that and, like, the heavy blue, orange, and green, like, Hoxbox-like colors from Federico Blay are really stunning.
A lot of this book, the art isn't what we normally see, and I really will always appreciate that Tsai's art direction and the way that the artists work with him really help push those boundaries of trying to give us a new, different experience. I don't know if I need to explore Kurt's sexuality again with Rogue, in the sense of we don't really need that storyline. That's not the narrative for him. But what I will say is I do appreciate the exploring of sexuality between Krakoan and Iraqi mutants. I think that's a fascinating relationship dynamic that we haven't gotten yet. You know, over in X-Men Red, we get a lot of political, we get a lot of ideology differences and how they either mesh or don't mesh. But here we're getting more, how do they relate more on a personal level? How do they relate on a sexual level? And I would really love that to be explored more.
Yes, Zen and Kurt is, despite being another heterosexual relationship, which is not a thing I don't like seeing at all, it's probably the best thing for Kurt in this book. It's the most interesting thing. I love writers remembering that Kurt is a sexual being. It's the reason that he ultimately does not, like, stay with the church, you know? I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that the art takes us to a lot of places that are conceptual and freewheeling and imaginative. That obviously stems in large part from Cy Spurrier's wanting to keep this on the astral plane or in various, like, sci-fi realms of existence. And I do really appreciate that. And as for the Rogue thing, I think that's a one-off joke that just doesn't really hit well with me.
The sense of whimsy and adventure in the drawings is just so amazing. On page right after we've been talking about where Kurt is kissing Rogue in his dreams, that panel right there, right after, where he looks like he's Pope Kurt, like, just is so beautiful and fantastical that I'm like, okay, I hate the idea of Pope Kurt, but, like, if that's what he's gonna look like as Pope Kurt, I can see it.
Yeah, it's funny how that art is extremely good, and I hate the narrative character choice there.
Like, yeah.
For him to be like, oh, this is getting really hot, and I have faith, and then to turn into a Pope in, like, defense of his sexuality.
The beautiful effects they use, especially with the different BAMFs, you know, like the fun the letterer had with the different BAMFs. Certain BAMFs have certain texture around their text bubbles. I really love the way that they played with that in the lettering.
There's actually a pretty clever bit. I really enjoyed this with Doctor Strange coming to the island, even though we all know he's dead. And it turns out to just be like a statue that is just posed to look like it's in action and that Pixie is interacting with. I thought that was a very funny bit to try to trick Switch into being trapped by these legionaries.
When I saw that, I was like, wait, what? I was like, when is this comic? I was like, Doctor Strange has been dead since before Inferno. And then I was like, come on, what's going on? And when I saw the faint of it all, I was like, okay, this is cool. But, like, at first I was very thrown, and I was very like, what?
I was like, well, they got me, gal. Oh, it was like a dummy or like a homunculus. And it was just like there. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I thought that Stephen Strange was actually a really good choice for that because of the fact that we've had the emphasis of Switch learning and using magic. That, I think, was very smart. But on the whole, yeah, I thought it was most likely Stephen Strange.
Switch when he comes in and he's like, ha ha, mine! I was like, twirl your mustache a little bit harder there, Switch.
When I saw him, I was like, Doctor Strange is dead. This can't be Doctor Strange, right? But then I was just so convinced by that pose, and I didn't realize that on the second page, he's in the identical pose still. So when he actually says, why can't I move these artful hands when Switch jumps into his body? In my mind, I was still fooled, and I was just like, oh, he can't move the hands because he doesn't know they're broken, because Stephen Strange has bad hands.
Shame on us for all thinking that Doctor Strange would just get taken over that quickly and fast without having any defenses.
He would have magical defenses.
He's a Sorcerer Supreme, and it shouldn't be that easy to mind control him.
Yeah, I agree with that very much. Something that I really genuinely liked was the idea of the congregation and Dust's role in it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think it's strange that everybody calls her Dust and she refers to the congregation when I feel like Way of X was trying to change her name to Congregation. I'm glad they didn't in the end, because I'm not really like fond of other mutants naming her after something that kind of feels more like a church, but I don't know.
I have qualms with the idea of Dust being the leader of the congregation as well, because, you know, we're taking one of the few prominent Muslim characters that we have in Marvel where, like, it's such a part of her identity, and then we're just sort of like, hey, cool, now she's the you know, helping guide this other mutant religion. It just seems suspect, her choice as the character to do that.
I get, like, why people didn't like Kurt leaving Catholicism and starting a mutant religion or whatever, but I think the two can coexist. But I also say, like, I want to say there's no shortage of Christian characters in comics is the thing.
I feel the same way.
Yeah. There's a huge shortage of, you know, Muslim, Jewish, other religions in general outside of the Abrahamic faiths. But, like, Christian characters are a dime a dozen a lot of the time. It heavily implied, if not directly outright.
Absolutely agreed. I feel the exact same way.
A thing I really do love in this issue, and it weirded me out the whole time because I don't like anybody calling Juggernaut Unki C. I don't like anybody, but I really enjoyed Juggernaut talking and, like, being vulnerable and opening up with Legion, since they're, like, Xavier's, like, unwanted bastards of the family. Right? Like, Xavier, most of the time, at least until maybe very recently, has treated Kane like, you know, a problem. Obviously, Kane didn't like Xavier, but I feel like there was always this simmering aspect of Xavier, like, seeing Kane as kind of like a blight on his family tree, and he definitely sees Legion that way. So it was nice to see these two characters with ties to Xavier, like, open up and be vulnerable to each other when they aren't with anybody else.
Professor X is so cruel in every book he is not actively in, and I just feel like I don't buy it. Like, I don't know, like, I just feel like that's such a disconnect for me.
Is it that Xavier would be cruel? Because that's, like, super obvious to me. I don't know,
him being cruel is one thing, but yeah. Like, the way he's been portrayed in the rest of the books that he's appeared in more regularly, I don't necessarily agree that he would flat out tell Kane no.
I respect that interpretation. This is an Xavier that I've felt was always there personally, and I've been living in this era. I think it's well known that I don't very much like Xavier, but I think he's a person who wants to do the best for mutant kind. But I think that often that means a very egotistical view of what is the best for mutant kind. And he's a person who has often mistreated those close to him, whether it be Scott or his many lovers or his several, like, kind of children. I think he's still capable of good things, and I think he still genuinely wants the best for mutant kind. I just don't think he necessarily always knows what that is, and he thinks he knows what is best.
That is fair, considering, you know, he took such an assimilationist view
yes.
for so long. I don't know. Like, the fact that Kane was living at the mansion for so long, he was part of the X-Men, it just feels like this is where he draws the line. He must leave the Legionnaires for him to help him. You know, like, he doesn't come up with another solution. He doesn't offer another one of the vast amount of telepaths, you know, on Krakoa. Emma, who helps pretty much everyone, I actually think she's way better at it than Xavier. Like, she wasn't brought up to help him with his issues. Like, he's just a blight. Like, to me, this goes against what we originally thought Krakoa was gonna be, where, you know, some humans were still gonna be able to live on the island, you know, as long as people vouched for them and whatnot. And we went backwards with their relationship instead of forwards.
That's very fair. Yeah. Ever since the Juggernaut series, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you're correct about that. That Xavier always was like cruel, but in a very manipulative way rather than like outright, like, I hate you to your face kind of way. I completely agree. And I think you're right about the going backwards.
For me, it was Franklin Richards, because that
is like plots Xavier.
That's what I mean, is like books he is not in, like the cruelty. It's just so, oh my gosh, it's so present, but then not in the books he's actually like, I just feel so heartbroken for like how he's being portrayed sometimes. And I don't want to feel heartbroken for freaking Xavier.
Yeah.
I just feel like, yeah, injustice.
I think you're right. I think I was just blinded by my mistreatment of Nightcrawler, and I'm like, ah, Xavier's fine.
I do love this establishing relationship of Kane and David. I love the interconnectivity. I talk about it a lot, where I love when things come together, and whether it's across all different titles or even in books, like I would love, especially in this Krakoan era, talking about characters here, Kurt and Rogue to talk about what's kind of going on with their moms. You know, they've had plenty of moments before, but like they've never had a moment, at least in this kind of title, of like talking about their relationship as siblings, talking about their moms.
Yeah, are you saying that they should spend some time alone together and talk about
Well,
it?
I mean, Gambit's over in Otherworld and really damaged right now, and maybe Rogue just needs someone to talk to and a furry shoulder to cry on.
Okay.
But I love this exploration of family dynamic. And to pivot to a character whose entire family seems to just be constantly mistreated, Banshee, I feel so bad for everybody who has the last name Cassidy, because, you know, we had Siren having to deal with the Morrigan. I was not very kind to how Marvel is currently treating Black Tom.
I don't like it either.
It's very important.
And Banshee, from not being able to do anything for 2 years now that we're in this post-Hoxpox Krakoan era, to being skinned alive by someone who had a deep emotional relationship with, to this... There are some characters that the X-Office really seems a little comfortable treating as disposable, in the sense of they can be the punching bag for like these really tragic things to happen to them. And it's a little weird to me.
I agree.
I'm on the same page. I completely agree.
Yeah, Banshee's had it pretty rough the last few years in publication history.
Few years? Oh my god.
Seeing Moira for the first time in decades, his long-lost love, and then for her to skin him alive.
Now he is Jason Aaron's Ghost Rider Banshee.
Oh, no.
But, you know, bad things happen to mutant characters, unfortunately, these days. And they always have. At least now they have some agency in it.
Does Banshee have agency?
Oh. No, he doesn't. I was being very sarcastic.
No Cassidy ever has any agency, apparently. Because all three of them just get fucked with. And it's weird. Marvel doesn't like this family.
It really is so strange.
Now Banshee's got to be saved by his brother-in-law on the team. Kane Marco?
His brother-in-law. He'll be there for him. There's kind of a family developing in this book. It's really funny. Like, not only that, but like the familial ties with like Blindfold now has like half a Destiny mask that shoots out a laser beam from the eye.
That is so cool.
I think that's really...
So you know how like there's been like the Bat family values, basically, where it's like the entire Bat family? I want that, but I want it Destiny and Mystique. So it'll have Rogue, it could have Ruth, it'll have Nightcrawler, it'll have Pyro, because Pyro's basically an adopted baby at this point.
Yeah.
We'll add some other people too, but that's what I want.
That's like such a good idea, Jonah. I'm actually kind of shocked that we have not had something like that before.
So long denying us the Mystique and Destiny family, and it sucked for so long, and it's so good to have them back and now doing stuff and referring to their kids. I would read the shit out of that family's book.
Yeah. I do think that we are very much missing a book that actually does that right now.
I don't know if this is a popular opinion or a controversial opinion, but I think Hickman's X-Men is very much that as well. It is just like a family dynasty friendship book. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the art, because that is absolutely my favorite part of this issue. Every time Jan Basaldúa has Juggernaut blast through a bunch of like fucking bottles and rubble and shit, it looks so damn good. Like in the very first issue, my very favorite page, and I can remember it so vividly, is Juggernaut busting through the bar and all the smashed bottles around him. Like the placement and the chaos of that arrangement is so good, the composition of the scene. And there's a full page splash where Juggernaut is in this one just blasting through like corpses and question mark corpses and blood. And the following page has like a really excellent panel of him just rushing across a long panel with everything flying up in his wake and the ground, you know, exploding underneath his thunderous feet. If this book could just be 90% panels by Jan Basaldúa of Juggernaut just blasting through shit, I would pick up every issue. It's very good.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I love how he's like, you know, busting through all these corpses, and then like he stops right there on the beach and everybody is like sexually playing volleyball.
Yeah, and Kane's like, look at all these dudes playing volleyball.
possible. He's like, ooh, picturesque views, and it's just like all the dudes are in front of him. I love it. It's great.
Yeah. Also, yeah. The dinosaur from Toy Story.
Oh, Rex. Yeah, that did not go unnoticed by me either. That was cute. I actually did like that.
I like that.
And we got Bamfs. I love little Bamfs.
That's a little Bamfs. And also maybe little Azrael Bamfs. Why are they red? Are they cardinal Bamfs?
Yeah. Wait, there are red ones? I didn't.
There are red ones. Yeah, later.
Oh god, I do see red ones. Can't we just forget he exists?
You know what? If Legion of X could fix the Draco as an arc, make it go away.
Yeah, bring back the Draco so that we can retcon it out of existence.
Out of existence.
So when Ruth is talking, how did she regress back to the talk that she used to talk when she was whispering to Cypher all along? That's what we found out, right? So like, that was supposed to always be because she was, you know, talking to Cypher and nobody else but Ruth knew that she was there.
I think it's a little strange that she still does that because Cypher is not like present with her, but I don't...
I want to assume that Cypher, she's just secretly there. We just don't see her. And that's just what it is, because I cannot handle the dialogue.
Yeah, I'm not fond of it. I think sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's funny, and I don't like when it's funny. Does that make sense?
Yes, I absolutely feel the same way.
So I don't really know a lot about Blindfold, so I don't know if I can fully comment on this, because I don't know who the character is.
She was Destiny's, like, great-granddaughter from...
Is she?
Well, yeah. Heavily implied, okay?
Why do we need that? Why?
She has the half-Destiny mask in this issue.
So, like, I noticed that as well, and I thought that was just like, okay, it's kind of like becoming a precog thing. But that's something I did not necessarily actually like, because I really want them all to have their own freaking agency from each other. Like, I don't like the idea of this character is a precog, so she has to be related to another precog. Like, people could have similar slash the same power sets and not be related. For that to happen.
I completely agree, but yeah, I mean, like, she's been like heavily implied to be Destiny's great granddaughter for like some time now.
Yeah. They haven't outright said it, it's been so implied, like in Necrotia, Destiny came back and went to talk to Ruth instead of actually Rogue. So like, there was an implied connection.
I know that sexuality is totally fluid. I've always known Destiny to very much always present as a lesbian.
Yeah, that's fair. You could. I just always assumed they adopted, like, because Mystique and Destiny are always adopting things. I always assumed they just... did somebody a long time ago.
But then why adopt this person who has the same, like, I don't know, like, the same power set thing is weird.
Yeah, you make some very valid points. I also don't think every mutant needs to be related, especially, like, if they're, I don't know, like, sometimes mutants of color all have to be related or married to each other.
Oh, yeah, I do not like that either. Sometimes
they all have similar powers. I don't like that trend, generally, but...
Same.
I didn't talk about her enough. I do love Weaponless Zin. I have a hard time with her at first because she's so similar to Cerise, to me.
Yes.
That, like, I'm like, I just wish he could use Cerise, but I know it wouldn't have fit the story.
Cerise was
like,
in this issue too.
In his mind, right next to him, kissing, you know, Weaponless Zin a whole bunch of times, and his Rogue, and maybe Betsy? I don't know.
Maybe Betsy.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, okay, Kurt.
We kind of didn't even really mention it. I do find the addition of Loki to this fascinating, especially because for anybody else reading Jane Foster and the Mighty Thor, where Jane Foster is currently in limbo and dealing with Sim. I love the interconnectivity that Marvel is currently playing with having everybody kind of visit other people's titles and books, because that really helps bridge the gap of a connected world for me.
Hey everybody, welcome back to X's for Podcast. I'm TK, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at XNateXGrayX.
Hey guys, I'm Drew. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Drewsipher3. That's at DREWSIPHER3.
Hey guys, I'm Broadway. You can find me on Twitter at BWAY3RD. That's BWAY, the number 3RD.
And today we are here to put the final lid on our coverage of the amazing 5-issue run of Victor Laval's Sabretooth. We're going to be talking about both issues 4 and 5 today, written by Victor Rachel Leval with art by Leonard Kirk. Ink specifically for issue 4 were done by Craig Young. Colors for both issues were done by Rain Barreto. Letters by VC's Corey Pettit. And design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. And of course, Ryan Stegman, JP Mayer, and Frank D'Armata on covers for both issues. And we are not stopping here for Sabretooth. We will be going on to Sabretooth and the Exiles. What'd you guys think about that particular piece of news?
A lot of people predicted it, and I'm glad that that came to fruition. It's not coming to fruition exactly as people think, with the Exiles not just being the folks that were in the pit that were exiled there, but also all of these other mutants on, like, the Orcus private prison, you know, Guantanamo Bay spaceship.
We're also getting, like, the toads and the nannies and orphan people, other people who've been down in the pit as well.
Yeah, which I'm very excited about. Talk about a great comeback from Nanny and Orphan Baker.
Yeah, this, I feel like this could really be their next big step after Hellions.
Yeah, and they were such a big part of Hellions, and like they were like a fan favorite, so to have them like in still, when I saw them on the page, I was shook.
Third Eye is a character that I've been very excited about in Sabretooth, and I've been really interested in, but one of my big fears, even when I thought this was going to be more like maybe a 9 or a 12 issue series, was that once Victor Laval was done, in some ways a best case scenario is another writer wouldn't necessarily be interested right off the bat, and you know, this character that I liked would disappear. But I also really feared that a writer that I didn't think maybe could handle the character in the way that Victor Laval, who created him, has done, would get a hold of him, and you know, we might get some storyline that I was really worried about. So I'm pretty excited that we get to see this particular character go on to be in another story and interact with more people under the pen of the person that created him and has really given him a voice that I think is really important to have on Krakoa, and especially to be a part of the conversation about justice that has been integral to really talking about Sabretooth.
Yeah, and Third Eye was also one of my standout favorites of like this series, just because I think his power is kind of unique. It's nice to have Victor Laval to keep writing him, like as we continue into Sabretooth and the Exiles, because if it was to be another writer, then it's just like kind of like the character I don't think is fleshed out enough. I would want more of the creator to flesh him out more until we get a new person writing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm excited about for the second series. Third Eye has not been fleshed out enough. And, you know, other characters have these long canons they can work from, and you can kind of pull from different stories. I would worry that just sort of throwing him out to the ether for somebody else to pick up, they might either backfill in things that were not Victor Laval's intent, or, you know, kind of miss things that were his intent. And I'm really glad that he's going to have time to flesh this character out. Because for me, there are still a lot of questions with him. Like, where did you come from? What did he want? And getting those fleshed out is really important.
I really love that we start issue 4 off with him in this like kind of vaunted position artistically, sort of floating above the rest of the Exiles, and seeing how his power works and how he's connecting with everyone on the island. He's not really doing too much interacting with everybody, but it does give us just even a basic idea of how we might see him come into play in X-Men stories going forward.
There are all these hints to his backstory. A lot of Black X-Men fans have talked specifically about the importance of having a Black telepath. We don't know exactly like the limitations of his powers, but it definitely is some sort of telepathic ability. The connection with the astral plane, the usage of the term conjure man, and sort of tapping into niche Black spirituality. I don't know if that like falls in the realm of kind of voodoo, but like there's an approach to this person's skills and powers that comes from a different cultural lens, and I think that's really beautiful. I think that's one of the perks of diversifying the X office.
When someone like Victor Laval comes in and pull from their own experiences and infuse a character with, you know, even if this is just kind of the lens through which they view their own powers that somebody else might view entirely differently, because it is from a voice that can speak to it with some sense of authenticity, it feels really natural for the character.
Agreed. It moves away from the kind of fetishistic or stereotypical approach that you might get with other powers, where it's like, ah, this person's powers are like this, because again, like they're Japanese and thus, and it's like, that's not, that doesn't really add up. Whereas like a conjure man is a specific kind of cultural term, and it, one, like adds to the mythology of those terms, but then it also adds depth to the culture without sort of imposing X-Men lore and fiction onto it or trying to map it on when it doesn't map. And I appreciate that.
I got really excited in the following pages when we got the view of Blink, Shark Girl, and then immediately after Skin and Blob, just having these touchstone moments with other characters from the mutant world who we don't necessarily get to see as much. And again, they're quick scenes, but written by Victor Laval rather than anybody else. It just felt like a little bit of a gift in a story that's really, really fun, but sometimes so dark that I forget to have fun while reading it. And of course, Sabretooth is having to reckon with the various sides of himself as all of these pieces are coming together on the island. And I found the introduction of, like, this, I guess, the Sabretooth that we know and love or hate, finally coming to the table to meet with the various parts of his personality. I don't want to say jarring, but I guess I was not expecting that Sabretooth himself was a personality that hadn't been present when looking at these characters previously.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious as to how that all going to like pan out. And also, you know, in tying in Third Eye, like, it's unclear like whose perspective we're seeing this from, and it is in Sabretooth's psyche. So I'm curious, like, is this something that's being like directed or manifested by Third Eye? Is it from Krakoa? Like, there's all kinds of questions about like how, like where and when Sabretooth is having these kind of connections. And there's an element of mystery there. There's an element of lore and you know, dreamscapes, etc. And that's something that's been present and in the construction of the story. And I think that's really what makes it shine in a lot of ways. I could also see it being very alienating because it's not as grounded as other stories.
I do think it's kind of interesting to see that perspective of Sabretooth. We've seen so many different kind of sides to him. It kind of makes sense to have like a, you know, the huge Sabretooth that made more sense in like the 90s versus like the one we have now.
There's a kid Sabretooth. There's a beastly version of the Sabretooth that we know like in his costume, but he has like giant cat teeth. There's cat Sabretooth, and then there's like suit wearing businessman Sabretooth.
I also am very fascinated by who or what the cat is, because all of these other facets of Sabretooth, we kind of understand what elements of his, like how they sort of mosaic together to form him, but we haven't really seen the cat do anything besides scratch Melter, which also, I'm here for bullying Melter. I just think it's funny.
The cat does scratch Melter, but it's not really super vicious, and I sort of wondered if this, it has something to do with his capacity to love or find things precious, which, you know, I feel like has to be a part of Sabretooth to make him as evil as he really is, that there is a part of him that could love or like could care about something, could care about a pet, or, you know, could be a pet, could just have that kind of wanton ability to take the world at face value.
The fact that it is like a house cat as opposed to like a panther,
right,
or like a tiger, or like an actual like saber tooth,
right,
because you never see that side of saber tooth, right? So it's like, you know, that's like the smallest cat you can get, right? So they're just like pushing it into like this tiny little thing.
And it's like domestic cat, as you were saying, and so like there are questions about, you know, domesticity, civility, etc.
Victor Laval is writing this amazing story that really calls into question our notion of justice and our notion of justice on Krakoa, and I'm stoked that he just has his own concept for what Sabretooth's psyche is and what makes it up. And in this case, it actually does not in any way need to be bound by comics continuity in order to be really interesting and definitive for the character.
It is definitive without having to draw on something previously established.
These pieces are all coming together. Sabretooth really is committed to getting them all out, and they're committed to doing the same with him, weirdly. Like, we know Sabretooth is a bad guy, but that doesn't mean anything any of us are okay with this situation. And if Sabretooth getting out is a consequence of what the council has done, then that's a consequence because it was their mistake.
It's also very poignant that the three black people are talking about their relationship with family and mutantdom. And as like a black queer person, I can't help but like pick up on those notes there. But once again, like I'm, to be clear, I stand Third Eye. I think he's awesome. He's also a bit sketch to me. And there's something he talks about being like an arcane assassin at the beginning, but also at this dinner, you know, he raises a glass as my pop raised me to believe in a cause that ruined him and me. And it's like, well, what's that about? And I know that Victor Laval described the story as a triptych, like three pictures that form one cohesive image. I'm curious if like the second part of this will be from Third Eye's perspective or will flesh him out more.
The other thing we get is the Third Eye's long description in a data page of how everybody ended up in the pit and what the reason that was given and what they actually did that the council didn't like. And I think it really is the final nail in the coffin for any argument on the council's side that they care about real justice or, you know, doing something better with the law than the world that they came from did.
The clearest examples to me are Madison Jeffries and Third Eye, because like Melter's been a villain before as his Necra. You could like wiggle through that, but with Madison Jeffries, like that he's been a part of this community for a long time and was attempting to make a home for the love of his life, who Danger is what I'm talking about, and like she has been an X-Men before. She's been like central to the running of Utopia, etc., etc., which is being picked up on in the pages of Wolverine. That didn't jive with Krakoa's organic structures and it kind of hurt Krakoa. And so they were like, so you know where you need to go? Hell. Or like Third Eye was like, hey, we have this baby problem. Like everybody needs to be aware of the consequences of their actions. And it lowered the birth rate. And they were like, well, you know where you need to go for forcing parents to reckon with the children they're creating? Hell. And I think that really wrote the line of thinking that said that the pit is in any way justified. There was no court, no trial, no nothing. And on a certain level, even if you think that they broke the law, which I guess in a literal sense they did, you have to ask, are those laws just? And what is the way that Krakoa adjudicate them or sort through that? And thus far, as we saw in I think issue 2 or issue 3, it Magneto and Xavier saying, ah, you did techno stuff that Krakoa didn't like? Hell. You ask people to wear condoms? Hell. Like, and they have to sit with that. And as the audience, like, that's our responsibility too. And I can tell by the discourse that's a little difficult for people.
And as we transition from 4 to 5, the big break finally happens and Sabretooth is out. Not really a surprise, I think. Starting at issue 1, it was only a matter of time before Sabretooth got out. I think it always had to be this way. And a comics writer might have made the big mystery, can Sabretooth get out or not? And with Victor Laval, you knew from the get-go that he was getting out. The question was, what would be the significance on a grander scale and how would we feel about it? And, you know, I'm still not somebody that is rooting for Sabretooth in all this, but I feel as though this is how it had to be. And it had to be this way, especially so that we could see Sabretooth meet Mystique and Destiny again, which truly a highlight of this entire series for me.
Whenever Mystique and Destiny are on the page, it's never bad. It's kind of like pizza. Even when it is bad, it's still pretty good.
Yeah, we will be eating on these two for years to come, I think, before anybody starts having complaints about them showing up.
Even the page where they let Sabretooth go, and there's something, I mean, Destiny's design is just iconic, but there's something about her whispering in Mystique's ears that you don't see any of it, and it's just this mask face, and Mystique is shocked, and then they're like, yeah, we choose chaos. But you know it has a point to it. One of the struggles for characters like Xavier is finding the purpose behind their actions, especially in a sort of Moiraless Krakoa. Like, Destiny and Mystique are driven by Destiny's visions and her diaries, etc., and you may not agree with their choices, but there is a purpose behind find them. I think Magneto is also working on that in X-Men Red, and I love that. There's just something so beautiful about these people who like know so much more than the rest of us, and they're just like, we choose chaos. That's simple.
And given that they're both on the council, you know, Destiny wasn't part of the vote. Mystique's choice to be a part of that, I think, kind of had more to do with choosing chaos than it did with justice. I find something more compelling and redeeming about their choice to let Sabretooth go in this moment than I do about the choice to put him in the pit in the first place.
Agreed. Yeah, speaking of council members, I do appreciate that Doug get his due as well, because Doug straddles this complex role of being like a non-voting member of the council, kind of. But like when Krakoa has an opinion, when like that the Krakoa warlock Doug Thruple decides like this is what's going to be happening, that it has weight. But he also doesn't sit at the table in the same way, but he has a role, which is what Sabretooth pointed out in issue 4, is like, you did this, you could have stopped this, just like they stopped the council from closing the external gate, right?
And we've been getting a lot of hints about Doug, Krakoa, and Warlock's status on the island, that they're being ignored. You know, Hope and the Five are being kind of ignored in this, like, it's gonna get political, and now Hope has shown up in Immortal X-Men and is on the council, and it's like, oh, now we gotta deal with this. I don't think anybody in the council actually understands that Krakoa, Doug, and Warlock are playing a completely different game, and if they at some point decide this whole thing is over, it doesn't matter what the council says. Krakoa is literally the land that they live on, and it's a living, thinking thing, and it can kick them all out. And when they decide to throw people in its stomach, it can get rid of all of them. And that is a decision that it's willing to make with Doug and Warlock without any input from the council. And A, that's awesome. B, I think it just, again, we're just seeing that the council, there's a whole book about them and how important they are and how important they think they are. And yet there are so many other levels on which games are being played and people are playing out their own ideas of what's right and wrong. We got the first hints of this with Doug in the X-Men Unlimited X-Men Green storyline, where they let Nature Girl and Curse go, and I'm really not surprised to see a very similar version of that same story happening here, where all of these other people are being let go, because it doesn't work for Doug and Krakoa and Warlock the way that I think the council was expecting it to. And again, it's that point that Sabretooth is not the good guy here. We're not saying, nobody's saying that Sabretooth being put in the pit and that being the original sin of the council means that we root for him to get out and we root for him to be some kind of protagonist. He's an awful person and he is a cancer to the island itself. And the fact that the council put the cancer in doesn't make anybody good here. And I think I particularly love that because it is a difficult concept for readers of superhero comics, especially, to reckon with in a superhero comic, that we don't have clear lines of good guys versus bad guys. Even in books sometimes where we're following a villain, we still have that line, and we might like the book because we are following the villain and we know that we hate him. This is a book in which we are following a villain, we know that we hate him, but we're not seeing a good guy opposite him to be like, oh, this is who we're rooting for, this is justice, this is a good thing. We just know that everything attached to this particular set of events is bad, and we need to get to the other side of it, hopefully with the best version of events that is possible, but there's really no good version.
Yeah, I feel like that is a very difficult tension to navigate. I think that's in my understanding, that's a perspective, that kind of heroic perspective is something that a lot of other people would say is a very American thing, right? Like sort of the central protagonist hero story. Not that those stories are distinctly American, but the inability to navigate the tension between, you know, the nation and the state being amoral and having moments of immorality or high morality and sitting with that tension. And I think that it is really powerful that story is being told, that story within the X-Men lore is being told by a Black American who, like, that is, like, profoundly the Black experience, is sitting within that tension of, like, well, the state does really awful things close to us. But then there are also these moments of like profound patriotism. I think about like my, you know, grandparents being veterans and things like that, or my grandparents being at the March on Washington. It's such a seminal American historical moment. And yet it's also in the face of rampant injustice from the state. And I think that sometimes it's very hard for comics readers, especially of the American variety, to sit with, when in fact that life, like these things are institutions, and institutions only have moral prerogatives if you give them one.
And I think Krakoa really reflects this idea that for a lot of us, and especially for the most marginalized among us, there's a feeling of, yeah, I hate the state, I hate the government, I in a lot of ways hate my country, but I love my community and I love the people that I surround myself with, and they are all Americans. And so there is a part of America that I love and I'm super proud of. In the same way, reading this current era of X-Men, I fucking hate the Council and I hate X-Force. I hate Beast right now. I'm getting a little sick of Wolverine for enforcing all these shitty laws. But there's so many people on Krakoa that I love, and I love the idea of mutants being able to form a community and get away from a world that demands that they suffer for them. That, of course, I love Krakoa, but I'm also really mad at a lot of parts of Krakoa. And I think having that experience for comics readers is right now pretty important.
Yeah, nothing in life is perfect, and Krakoa hasn't been perfect since day one, obviously, with this book being based off, as we like to say here, the original sin. For me, it's like those parts are still what make it interesting, and those add to the stories. And like, yeah, like I hate that Beast is being such like an asshole in X-Force, but it's kind of like, to me, it's riveting. So I'm just like more.
And then, you know, lastly, Sabretooth is captured by Orcus and going to Orcus's mutant prison. We are adding yet another concept, or a concept of justice, or a concept of a total lack of justice, again, being done to Sabretooth. It's so interesting because we don't want to see this stuff. We don't want to see the massive moral failings of Krakoa, but we have to, because these are people, and of course they are going to be human and falter and do horrible things and make mistakes. And if we have to explore how they do that, it's good that we have a character like Sabretooth that we don't sympathize with. So even if we know what's happening to him is wrong, and we have to accept that, and eventually we will have to reckon with it. In the meantime, because we want to have complex stories in which we explore these things, we've got a character that, if he's the one that goes from the shitty mutant prison to the shitty prison for mutants, I really want to see what that prison is, and I'm glad it's not happening to a character I love a lot more.
Agreed. I think it is important to show these stories about the worst of us, not that you can build empathy with that person specifically, but so that you can ground your morals and ideals and politics in something more universal and foundational. But like, for just a second, recently, you know, R. Kelly was sentenced and is like going to jail. And I was like, hooray for that. But also, I am still anti-prisons, right? So like, Sabretooth is facing consequences for his actions, but I still have a foundational problem with the lack of justice and the lack of imagination there. And you can sit in both of those things, and, you know, going from the mutant prison to prisons for mutants, as you so aptly said, is really important to see like the parallels between the two of them. And I think that that is part of the triptych of it all, is that you're seeing what mutants do to each other, what humans do to mutants. And I don't know what the third prong will be, but maybe the synthesis or rejection of both of those things. But, you know, if you think that mutants are being bad to each other, wait till you see what it looks like when their, you know, their oppressors weaponize the same systems and ideologies for profit, no less.
Ending on Mystique and Destiny, again, after we left them off with We Choose Chaos, and they're sort of looking off in the distance, as they often do together, kind of predicting what will happen. I think the chaos that Destiny is really eager to introduce is Sabretooth into Orcus, and how he might act kind of against his own intentions as a liberator for mutant kind amongst their worst oppressors. And I kind of wonder if that third prong of the triptych is Sabretooth realizing that there is something about the worst parts of him that, despite his best efforts, still might be able to be good. Like, not morally, but that even the worst of us can find something that our worst instincts can do to better the world.
Right, that he can use his saber-toothiness for the benefit of mutant kind without compromising his kind of saber-toothy self-interest. I really like that Destiny and Mystique are operating as these prime movers. It really, like, emphasized the Destiny and the Destiny of X, and we see this both with the upcoming conflict with the Eternals, but now also this situation with the Orcus Corporation. I think there's something really brilliant about using the future seer using her future sight to weaponize Sabretooth against Orcus.
This person might be leading a bloody rebellion which will benefit so many mutants, but he's not doing it for that. He's doing it because that gets him out. And how does he reckon with the fact that, despite the fact that he swore that he was never going to do good and he was always going to be self-interested and he loved murder, he just helps all these mutants escape and get back to the lives that they want? I think that's a really interesting path to go down with Sabretooth, and Victor Laval is the person that needs to be doing this story. It's very clear.
Agreed. I think Victor Laval's writing for this series has probably been one of my favorites so far in the Destiny of X era. It's definitely probably one of my top three books after Immortal and X-Men Red.
Yeah, I think there is a beauty in expanding the canon of comic writers. That is just something I'm seeing a lot these days, the diversification of who gets to write stories. One of my favorite kind of podcasters and comedians, Ira Madison III, a culture critic, probably what he would drive himself as, got to write in one of the Pride issues. And it's those little things where you're expanding the canon of who gets to tell stories, and at its like maximum you get this, and it doesn't feel like a traditional comic book story, and yet that feels really good and refreshing and powerful. So I'm really grateful. Victor, if you're listening, thank you.